This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
You can't see them, but they're out there. Billions of microscopic life forms just waiting for their chance to grab hold of something and start to grow. And that includes you.
So there's always going to be a battle between pathogens and us in terms of survival.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, our astrobiology series gets small with a look at the tiniest life on the planet and see how it fares while off the planet. We'll also spend an academic minute dealing with the issues caused by space travel. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Communities of microorganisms are all around us in nature and play important roles in processes that directly impact human life. Every day, these microorganisms contribute to environmental remediation, wastewater treatment, and assistance in food digestion, as well as biofouling, biofilm-related corrosion, and hospital-acquired infections. To that end, scientists are using these microorganisms in the development of therapeutics that specifically target the balance between good and bad bacteria in the human body. The Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter David Gastina spoke with Dr. Cynthia Collins, assistant professor in the Department of Chemical and Biological Engineering at the Center for Biotechnology and Interdisciplinary Studies at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, about her work on microbes and how they are affected by gravity and how that might be affected by spaceflight.
And so one of those big words in there is Pseudomonas aeruginosa. And that is a gram-negative bacteria, and it's a common opportunistic pathogen. So, you know, if you're healthy,
a what?
An opportunistic pathogen. So it's a microbe that can cause infection, but really it doesn't do so unless you're immunocompromised or you have a wound. And so it's a really important microbe because it's kind of around, and so you'll find it on, you know, everywhere. And also because it's a big cause of hospital-acquired infections. And so if you're in the hospital and, you know, for, you know, surgery or because you have something else, that tends to be, you know, one of the ones that you get. So it's important that we understand how it affects.
And we have some pretty high hospital infection rates at certain hospitals. And so this is the kind of thing that can be applied, you know, on the ground.
Sure, definitely on the ground. And so we're looking at it and how it grows and how it's affected during space flight. So on the shuttle. And so this is more thinking about what happens to us and to the microbes that we interact with if we want to, you know, go on a long-term space flight, so to the moon or to Mars and beyond, hopefully. And we don't really know how microbes are affected by gravity. We know that people have observed for a while that bacteria tend to grow better under some circumstances and some microbes when they're on shuttles or in space flight. And we don't really know all of the reasons why. And we also know that humans can become immunocompromised or immunosuppressed during space flight. And that's been observed on, you know, astronauts undergoing some decrease in immune function. And so it's really important for us to understand how microbes and the human interact during space flight because, right, our bodies have 10 to 100 times more bacterial cells in them than human cells. And those are really important for our happy, healthy functioning. And of course, there's balance between things that can cause infection and the good bacteria in our bodies. And so if we understand those interactions and how that might be affected during space flight, then we have a better chance of being able to conduct these, you know, missions where being in an enclosed environment, somewhat like a hospital, for a long period of time is going to be really important to our success.
Well, something that you've been very successful at is doing this basic research with a little help after becoming the prestigious Faculty Early Career Development Award winner from the National Sciences Foundation, a very prestigious award, as I understand it. You were given 5 years, approximately over $500,000 to develop these systems for coordinating the behaviors of microbes. You were just telling us about this. And in entirely new types of engineered microbial communities. So you're actually going to be doing some engineering here.
Sure. So that project, which is not really related to spaceflight, is one of the things that my lab is interested in terms of engineering bacteria that will work together to carry out some sort of process. And we know that in nature and in our bodies and, you know, soil, bacteria exist in complex communities and they carry out really interesting chemical processes. And from an engineering standpoint, we'd really like to take advantage of those abilities because, you know, we use microbes to produce industrially and biochemically relevant compounds for industry and biotech. But we usually use single microbe systems. So we might use something like E. coli or yeast. But if we use combinations of different microbes, we might be able to do things faster or with higher yields. But this is a really fun and challenging and problem because getting things to coexist and to work together requires some understanding of the chemistry that they conduct, but also things like ecology and how they interact and what's going to make them grow with the appropriate, you know, community dynamics. And then, of course, being able to engineer kind of interactions between those microbes. And so that project is really focusing on engineering communication between microbes that don't naturally communicate. But some microbes do communicate, and we take advantage of some of the systems that they use for that. So the system we start with is called quorum sensing, and it's essentially a small molecule sensing and production system where the bacteria produce these small molecules and they diffuse through the cell membrane. And so you can imagine that if they're free swimming in the ocean, that they diffuse away. But once these cells start to accumulate, whether or not it's in a symbiotic system or a pathogenic system, so a good system or a bad system, in a very simplified way to think about it, these small molecules start to accumulate because they can't move away. And the cells recognize this, and then they change their gene expression. So they change what proteins are expressed and what functions they can carry out. And this gives them different types of advantages in terms of being able to be better at infecting things or better at surviving under different conditions, because you can imagine free swimming in the ocean versus inside of a symbiotic organism. They have different needs and requirements, and this gives them a really cool way that they can adapt and survive.
So as you're engineering here,
yes.
Give us some more of these applications. What else are you applying this to? I think I can see where you're going, but
sure.
For our listeners.
So what we would like to do is to think about new ways to, say, you know, produce biofuels, where instead of trying to make one microbe that can do the whole process, which takes a lot of engineering, instead we can separate this out into two or three different microbes where one is responsible for, you know, a couple steps in the process, the other is responsible for some others. And so you can divide it up, which makes engineering a little bit easier. We call this modularity. So, you know, instead of having to make everything work under one, you know, one cell, you can say, well, this cell's going to do part of it, this cell's going to do the other thing. So it's worth talking about synergy. And so we know that if we look at a microbial community, the kind of the sum of the parts is greater, right, than each individual. And so we're trying to emulate that through engineering, where we can get something that works better than an individual by combining different things together.
And as you're doing this, what are the tools in your arsenal that you're using?
So we use a lot of what we call synthetic biology tools. And so from a synthetic biology point of view, we try to essentially plug and play with biological systems, which is really fun. And so, you can think about it as analogous to some sort of like digital devices. So from a digital perspective, we might have switches where we turn things on and off when we want them to. And we can combine those into things where you sense multiple inputs and then have some sort of behavior.
Is this a chemical turn on and turn off?
Sure. And in our system, it's often a chemical system. Instead of it being an electrical switch, it's a biological switch or a chemical switch. So you essentially have cells, they recognize some sort of chemical, and then they switch their behavior. And so we try to rewire things. So for example, the quorum sensing system I just described, there's a switch that happens when cells get to high cell density because a single microbe both produces and recognizes that signal. And so in our engineered systems, what we have is we take those parts, the signal production and signal recognition, and we put them in different organisms. So now you have signals, instead of it being about density, it's about, is some other guy there and what are they doing?
We're talking with Dr. Cynthia Collins, assistant professor in the Department of Chemical and Biological Engineering at RPI, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York. It's a fascinating discussion. I fear I went a little too fast past the issue of the space shuttle mission, because this is very exciting, obviously, for RPI. And I'm sorry, just as a human being, it's exciting to be involved with the space shuttle. But obviously, this was in June 2011. This had to do with the last shuttle mission. And your lab is studying these biofilms. So let's go back to this.
Okay.
Biofilms, what you're studying, and its attachment to the space shuttle.
Sure. So we are looking at how biofilms, and so biofilms are these three-dimensional communities that of bacteria and other microorganisms that are attached to surfaces. So that stuff on your teeth in the morning, right, which is always there.
Ooh.
And this is the natural way bacteria, exist. So they're in these complex, three-dimensionally structured communities. You know, they're not in the test tubes that maybe we think about. And so it's really important to study them in that form. And so we're interested in how, you know, these communities are affected by spaceflight. And so we had a couple of really wonderful opportunities in 2010 and 2011 to actually send some experiments up on the space shuttle, where we essentially grew samples and looked at how much biofilm they formed. And so we were able to look at both how much viable cells there were and then look at the biofilm structures that are formed and compare those to what we saw in normal gravity.
Are these films on the outside of the space shuttle, inside the space shuttle? Where are they?
It's unlikely, although there's some possibility that you would have things growing on the outside of the shuttle. And so if you think about Mir, right, so this is the first space station, you know, there were lots of biofilms on surfaces there. And there were issues of corrosion, which is one of the things biofilms can cause, and also plugging up their water filtration system. And as you can imagine, being on a long shuttle mission, you need to be able to reuse your water. And so you want to make sure that you don't have biofilms clogging things up, which is one of the things they can do that's not so great.
Is this like in my house? We have mineral-rich water, and a lot of times you have to clean out the shower head because it fills up with this film?
Yeah, exactly. It's the same kind of thing. And so you can imagine that you really need to be careful about these things on the shuttle and on the space station. And, you know, NASA engineers have been aware of this and work on it, but it continues to be a challenge, right? And especially without the shuttle or for a while without our, you know, something like a Mack truck, right, or a semi that can take new parts up there, right? We have the Soyuz, and hopefully soon we'll have SpaceX Dragon being able to take things up there, but we have a little while to wait. So the ones we're looking at, they're in like double containment systems. So there's no risk to the astronauts of actually being exposed to the microbes we're looking at. And we're looking at them actually in what we call an artificial urine media. And so because being able to get your water back out of urine is really important, and also a place where you could have infections both inside the body, and then it could be clogging things outside the body. So we thought this was a physiologically and, you know, relevant kind of system to be using, although it's kind of gross to think about. And so we found with the Pseudomonas that during spaceflight, we actually saw more biofilm forming than in our ground controls. And so one of the really challenging things or important things about these experiments is to being able to compare things on the ground, right, our Earth side of things, to what we see in spaceflight. So we ran the same experiments, you know, in a lab at Kennedy Space Center while the astronaut was doing things on the space shuttle for us.
Describe the excitement with your team with a project like this.
It's very, very exciting. It, you know, everything is rushed, but, you know, having these kinds of opportunities, especially at the end of the shuttle mission when, you know, I've been watching them for my entire life was, you know, it wasn't even something I had really dreamed of. You know, it was so exciting. And my lab, you know, for the last two summers got to spend pretty much a month in Florida. Spending a month in Florida in the summer is not the greatest thing unless you get to send, you know, samples up on the shuttle mission. And so for my lab and I, it was a great bonding experience. I'm a pretty young professor. And so getting that kind of, you know, we get to go to camp, right? And it's a really good bonding and fun experience for everyone. And there's just nothing, you can't beat the excitement, especially that last shuttle mission, the kind of buzz that was in the air. Everyone's very excited, a little bit of sadness kind of at the end of the mission, but one of probably the greatest opportunities I've had and probably will have.
And I imagine the opportunity, once those minds get working together to come up with something larger than any one of you, is really the potential there.
Yeah. And it's been wonderful for me to see, you know, my students kind of grow and mature and, you know, come up with their new ideas. And, you know, I'm excited to see them, you know, finish up and go take on and be professors in other labs and those kinds of things.
Still to come, more of David Gustina's conversation with Dr. Cynthia Collins and the world of microbes. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1135. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Cynthia Collins, an assistant professor of chemical and biological engineering at the Center for Biotechnology and Interdisciplinary Studies at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. She's speaking with the Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter, David Gastina.
Let's get to the real meat of it, though, Dr. Collins. You know, how does one get involved in such a subject? You just said you're a young professor. I can attest to that as I look at you across the table here. But, you know, it takes a certain amount of focus and energy to do what you've done at your young age. So what got you interested in all of this to begin with?
Well, I always loved science, and I had, you know, great science teachers, especially in high school, and then great teachers in college. And as soon as I got in the lab doing a little bit of one-on-one right research as an undergraduate, I was like, this is what I'm supposed to do. All that coursework, that's okay, but put me in a lab, and I kind of felt like I was at home. And then I was lucky enough to have opportunities to go do a PhD, and that was also, you know, very fulfilling time, but very challenging. And I think, you know, there's a great story on NPR a couple of weeks ago about science being really challenging, but it's worth it. And, you know, I really hope, you know, more young women and young men think about this and the opportunities, because it's definitely worthwhile in the long run. But in terms of getting involved with NASA, as a young PI, one of the challenging things is getting funding to do research. And so one of the things NASA is interested in is essentially how systems respond to gravity. And because I had studied bacteria and I was interested in how they communicate, which is part of biofilms, it just seemed like a good fit. And so we got some funding and this opportunity kind of came from there. And it's been really fun because, you know, I think NASA was looking for some young PIs to bring a different perspective and some new energy, especially at the tail end of the system, the shuttles. And so, you know, I just feel like we got a wonderful opportunity.
Certainly sounds like an incredible opportunity, and the research is just so fascinating. You just mentioned gravity, and with some of the other scientists we've interviewed and some of my own sort of anecdotal research, this is a central question, right? I mean, we still don't fully understand gravity, despite all the technological improvements, the kind of research that you're doing on the microscopic level, but we still don't understand one of the most basic things, Newton's law of gravity.
Sure. And I'm not a physicist, so I probably can't tell you so much more about that. But really, you know, looking at bacteria and trying to see, you know, what are they responding to? They're so small, we don't really expect them to be, you know, recognizing and responding to gravity. They certainly haven't evolved mechanisms to respond to gravity. And so what the changes we do see result from other things, the change in small molecule movement that happens in space because things like convection are affected, which are, you know, important physical processes. And so that's kind of our next step, is to say, well, okay, we've observed this happens. We have a good, really solid biological observation. Now we can go back and look at the physics of what's going on and say, well, this is what we observe. This is what they're really responding to, which I think ties everything together.
As we go forward and you look ahead in your career and what you see coming down the research pike, so to speak.
Well, I think there's always going to be a challenge in terms of viruses evolve, right, just like we do. And we come up with new solutions. And, you know, it's hard, you know, it's important to remember, right, we didn't even have any available antibiotics, you know, until 1940s, 1950s when, you know, we built the technology or, you know, to mass produce these kinds of things. And so there's always going to be a battle between pathogens and us in terms of survival. But, you know, I think we have some new tools and new ways to think about engineering biological systems where we can kind of plug and play and build things in new different ways, which is something NASA is actually interested in the long term. And, you know, being able to say, well, we've made it to Mars. Can we synthesize DNA that will let, you know, a microbe produce some sort of material that we can build a house from or some sort of structure or build things that you can eat? And so that you're not necessarily required to take everything with you. You can actually say, well, I have this stock of microbes. I have a DNA synthesizer. Can I put them together? Which sounds a little...
But for a trip to Mars, that could be
sure,
useful.
It would be really useful because you can't take everything you need with you. And one of the wonderful things about biological systems is they can adapt. And to some extent, we can engineer them now. There's a long way to go in terms of getting there, both from a technological perspective and, you know, finding the funding to go to Mars. But I think there's a lot of potential and a lot of ways in which, you know, now we have the tools, we can start to get biological systems to do things we couldn't do before.
Is there any caution here? Is there anything in the engineering that you're doing that could produce something not expected, perhaps not so good?
I think there's always challenges in terms of making sure that things are done safely and, you know, making sure that things don't get out into the environment that, that shouldn't be. And there's some great work from other labs, you know, with these synthetic systems where there's kind of catches in there so that if something gets out into nature, it can't survive on its own. And so that, yeah, so things like that are important. And there are definitely groups that are considering those things because, you know, we want to make it so that people have the ability to engineer these systems because they're, you know, there's so much potential. But you want to, you know, we want to keep things in check in terms of safety and, you know, making sure that you don't have a new microbe that goes and takes over, you know, kind of like the issues with fish that are unnatural Chinese fish, I can't remember the name of them right now, that are, you know, taking over some of the Great Lakes. So you have invasion of species. And so we want to be careful about those. And of course, there's also bioterrorism and things, right, where we want to make sure that people are safe and things don't get into the wrong people's hands.
Dr. Cynthia Collins is an assistant professor of chemical and biological engineering at the Center for Biotechnology and Interdisciplinary Studies at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York. She spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter, David Gustina. Our coverage is made possible by the NASA Astrobiology Institute through support from the New York Center for Astrobiology, located at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, in partnership with the University at Albany, the University of Arizona, and Syracuse University. You can learn more on all the topics in our astrobiology series at origins.rpi.edu. The growth of microbes isn't the only thing we have to pay attention to when thinking about spaceflight. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. The International Space Station has allowed individual astronauts to spend hundreds of days in space. But as Jason Kring, assistant professor of human factors and systems at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, explains, a multi-year mission to Mars will make new and unknown physical demands on its crew.
I hope I'm still around when we send the first humans to Mars. Certainly my 5-year-old daughter will witness this remarkable journey. She might even be one of those selected for the Mars crew and join the ranks of women space pioneers like Valentina Tereshkova, Sally Ride, and Eileen Collins. The choice of who makes that first flight is the focus of my research at Embry-Riddle. We're trying to find the best combination of people for long-duration space missions. Each person on a crew has unique qualities that affect how they interact and work together. For example, nationality and culture affect how people communicate and their needs for privacy and personal space. But the most basic difference is gender. So, what is the best combination of men and women for a space crew? In other places with extreme isolation and confinement, like Antarctic research stations, teams of both men and women tend to have higher levels of morale and productivity when compared to all-male teams. Other research shows mixed-gender teams make better decisions. But a space mission simulation in the 90s revealed that interpersonal and romantic relationships between men and women can lead to miscommunication and conflict. So this raises a number of important questions. Should we send married couples or a group of single men and women to Mars? Should there be a, quote, no dating policy during that 3-year journey in space? We need to answer these questions because the biggest obstacle to a successful Mars mission is not the technology, it's the human factor. The future of human spaceflight depends on not only finding people with the right stuff, but finding the right mix of men and women to expand our horizons in the cosmos.
That was Jason Kring of Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.